Welcome to the October 2010 session of the International MD Support Group. I'm Dan Roberts, here with Dr. Ed Huggett, as usual, and our guest presenters this month are Karen McCauley and Dr. Roy Cole from the Jewish Guild for the Blind in New York City. Their topic is one of growing importance for our aging population, dealing with the risks of vision loss secondary to diabetes. Karen McCauley has been a registered nurse for 21 years and a certified diabetes educator since 1993. Ms. McCauley has had the privilege of caring for individuals with diabetes in a critical care setting as well as providing insulin pump training in their homes. She is presently working at the Jewish Guild for the Blind as a certified diabetes educator and program coordinator for the Maxine and John Bendheim Center for Diabetes Care. Dr. Roy Cole, who we've had the pleasure of having as a presenter before, about 3 years ago, I believe it was, Doctor, is the Director of Vision Program Development at the Jewish Guild for the Blind in New York City and an adjunct professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at Columbia University. Previously, he was a professor at the State University of New York's College of Optometry. He's also a low-vision diplomate in the American Academy of Optometry. Ms. McCauley and Dr. Cole, it's good to have you with us today.
Karen McCauley here. Good afternoon. Thank you, Dan, for the introduction. It is a pleasure for me to be here with you to present on diabetes and vision loss. We hope our audience will enjoy and learn from the presentation. I have listed objectives here. I have four objectives listed. Number one, our audience will develop a better understanding of diabetes, including prediabetes, type 1, type 2, and gestational. The second objective is to know the risk factors for diabetes. The third objective listed on the slide is learn how diabetes can affect your vision, including both signs and the symptoms. And lastly, our fourth objective is to have a better understanding of diabetic retinopathy and the available treatments for it. So we're going to talk a little bit about what is diabetes, and I have four conditions that I will discuss briefly. But diabetes is a group of diseases characterized by high blood glucose levels that result from problems with the body's ability to produce and or use insulin. On our slide here, I have listed four types of diabetes, and I will begin to discuss them. Number one, I have the condition prediabetes. Before people develop type 2 diabetes, they most always have prediabetes. With prediabetes, blood glucose levels are higher than normal, but not yet high enough to be diagnosed as diabetes. So I would like to clarify that further by saying normal fasting blood glucose is below 100. A person with prediabetes has a fasting blood glucose level between 100 and 125. If the blood glucose level rises to 126 or greater, a person has diabetes. Now, in terms of statistics, there are 57 million people in the United States who have prediabetes. There are several things you need to know if you do have prediabetes, and they are, number one, you can and should do something about it. Studies have shown people with prediabetes can prevent or delay the development of type 2 diabetes through lifestyle changes, which include modest weight loss. And what I mean by modest weight loss is a 5 to 10% loss of body weight and regular exercise. And again, an example of exercise would be modest physical activity for 30 minutes a day. And lastly, making healthier food choices is very important. People with prediabetes don't often know that they have it. Therefore, if you are overweight and age 45 or older, you should be checked for prediabetes during your next routine medical office visit. If you are of normal weight and you're over age 45, you should ask your doctor during an office visit if testing is appropriate. For adults under 45 and overweight, your primary care provider may recommend testing if you have any other risk factors for diabetes or prediabetes. And I will be discussing risk factors as we move along with the presentation. In terms of type 1 diabetes, type 1 diabetes was previously known as juvenile diabetes and insulin-dependent diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is usually diagnosed in children and young adults. In terms of statistics, with this type of diabetes, only 5 to 10% of people with type 1 with diabetes, overall diabetes, have this form of diabetes. And in type 1 diabetes, the body does not produce insulin. Insulin is a hormone that is needed to convert sugar, starches, and other food into energy needed for daily life. So to further clarify this, I'd like to say that insulin acts like a key to open the door to allow sugar to enter the cells so the cells can carry out their functions. Insulin injections or an insulin pump is a necessary treatment for this type of diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is more prevalent in the non-Hispanic white population. Now, moving along to type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes was previously known as adult onset diabetes and non-insulin dependent diabetes. It's usually found in adults, but now more children and teens are developing type 2. And type 2 is the most common form of diabetes. Some groups have a higher risk for developing type 2 diabetes than others, and I will be discussing this as we move forward. In type 2 diabetes, either the body does not produce enough insulin or the cells ignore the insulin. And again, insulin is important because it takes the sugar from the blood into the cells. Insulin is necessary for the body to be able to use glucose for energy. Many people are unaware that they are at high risk for this type of diabetes. I'm moving along now to gestational diabetes. Gestational diabetes starts when the body is not able to make and use all the insulin it needs for pregnancy. So during pregnancy, usually around the 28th week or later, many women are diagnosed with gestational diabetes. This form of diabetes affects about 4% of all pregnant women in the United States each year. A diagnosis of gestational diabetes does not mean that you had diabetes before you conceived or that you will have diabetes after you give birth. It is important to follow the doctor's advice and recommendations regarding blood glucose levels so you and your baby remain healthy. A woman who has had gestational diabetes is more likely to develop type 2 diabetes later on in life. There are several risk factors for diabetes on the slide, and I'm going to begin with your weight. Being overweight is a risk factor for diabetes. Being overweight can keep your body from making and using insulin properly. Excess body weight can also cause high blood pressure. You may have heard about BMI, which is an abbreviation for body mass index, or you may have seen a BMI table in the doctor's office or in magazines. BMI is a measurement of body weight relative to height. So you can use a BMI to see whether you are underweight, normal weight, overweight, or obese. Continuing along with risk factors for diabetes, if you have a parent, a brother, a sister who has diabetes, that puts you at a greater risk for coming down with type 2 diabetes. Before I mentioned there are certain groups that have a higher risk for diabetes, and they are African Americans, Hispanic Latinos, Native Americans, Asian Americans, or Pacific Islanders. In terms of activity, if you are inactive and lead a sedentary lifestyle, that again is a risk factor for type 2 diabetes. If you had a baby weighing more than 9 pounds or you had gestational diabetes, when you were younger, that's a risk factor for coming down with diabetes. I have three more points I wanted to mention here. If you have high blood pressure or hypertension, that puts you in the risk category. And also, if you have low HDL, low HDL is not a good thing to have, and I would like to give you some numbers here. Low HDL for men would be less than 40, and for women, it would be less than 50. HDL is the good cholesterol. So with HDL cholesterol, higher levels are better. And the last point on the slide I would like to mention is triglycerides. If you have high triglyceride levels, that puts you at risk for diabetes. Just to give you some information here, if needed, a normal triglyceride level is less than 150. All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about how can I reduce my risk. There are risk factors that you can modify. Therefore, you can do a lot to lower your chances of getting diabetes. And essentially, what I wanted to say is maintaining a healthy lifestyle is the key to risk reduction. I have some topics here listed on the slide, and the first one is diet. Healthy eating is one of the most important things you can do. And now, this can be difficult if you are short on time or on a budget. Some suggestions are to purchase leaner meats and low-fat dairy products, buy whole grain bread and cereals, increase vegetables and fruit into your diet, and lastly, portion control is very important, portion control of the food that you're taking in. The next topic I wanted to discuss in terms of risk factors is exercise. By increasing your level of physical activity and staying active, you can help manage your blood glucose, blood pressure, and cholesterol. Additionally, physical activity lowers your risk for heart disease and stroke. In terms of medical considerations, I have screening listed here. Screening is usually up, screening for diabetes, that is, or screening for risk factors, is usually up for your healthcare provider. Anyone 45 years or older should consider getting tested. Of course, if you are 45 or older and overweight, being tested is highly recommended. If you are younger than 45 and overweight and have one or more risk factors, you should consider getting tested. And in terms of treatments, following treatments prescribed for you is important. So lowering blood pressure and cholesterol levels also helps you stay healthy. Maintaining a healthy weight and healthy lifestyle are very important to reducing your risk for diabetes. All right, so let's look a little bit about the situation of when you have diabetes. So I have here a question on the slide, how can I control diabetes? Self-monitoring your blood glucose is essential. The meters available today are also designed with different features and functions to meet the needs of its users. In addition to monitoring blood glucose, there are other things required to control this disease. And the first thing I'd like to discuss is, again, food or food choices. Your diabetes diet is simply a healthy eating plan that will assist you in controlling your blood sugar. Instead of a restrictive diet, a diabetes meal plan is naturally high in nutrients, low in fat and calories. There is emphasis on fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. A diabetes diet involves eating a variety of nutritious foods in moderate amounts and adhering to regular meal times. In terms of exercise, four kinds of activity can help you control your diabetes. You can be extra active on a daily basis. Aerobic exercises are also suggested. Strength training is also suggested, and stretching is also a form of physical activity. Speaking with your healthcare provider prior to engaging in increased activity is necessary. And there are a few more points I wanted to mention on exercise. Exercise can lower your blood sugar or cause what a term we call hypoglycemia, and hypoglycemia is blood sugar less than 70. So in people who are taking insulin or certain types of medications, exercise can pose a risk for hypoglycemia. So hypoglycemia can occur during or after exercise and even up to a day later. So discuss this with your healthcare team, and when in terms of exercise, it would be very important to discuss what type of exercise is suitable, and in, also in the discussion to include hypoglycemia prevention, causes, and treatment. In terms of medicine, medicine may also be needed to control blood sugar. Sometimes a single medication will do the job, and in other cases, a combination of medications are necessary to achieve glucose control. Diabetes drugs work in different ways. Many are available in pill forms, and others need to be injected under the skin. It is important to follow the directions given to you by your healthcare provider or healthcare team regarding your prescribed medication. Okay, I have other considerations listed here on the screen, and I would like to just mention a little bit about smoking. Smoking increases complications for those who have diabetes. Smokers have a higher risk of developing many other chronic disorders. So if you do smoke, please seek assistance to stop. It's very important. I have stress listed here. Stress can complicate diabetes by distracting you from proper care or affecting blood glucose directly. Some sources of stress are never going to go away no matter what you do, and having diabetes may be one of them. There are ways to reduce stresses of living with diabetes, and support groups can help. If you need help with any of these issues, ask a member of your diabetes team for a referral. Talking with a therapist may also help with your problems. Depression, I wanted to speak about. People with diabetes are at greater risk for depression than people without diabetes. Depression can get you into a vicious cycle. It can interfere with good diabetes care. If you are depressed and have no energy, chances are you will find simple tests like regular blood glucose testing too much. So please discuss your feelings with your primary care provider. I have some information here on cost factors and insurance. As we know, people who have diabetes and people who don't, diabetes is an expensive disease. So I have some tips here on managing the medical cost, and I'd like to mention using a mail order prescription service. You can also ask your doctor for samples at each visit because they often have an excess, and drug companies don't seem to mind to provide the patients with samples. You can speak with your doctor about generic drugs. Again, don't be embarrassed to ask your doctor for advice. You are not alone. Some drug companies that sell insulin or diabetes medications usually have patient assistance programs. Such programs are available only through a physician. So discuss with your primary care provider these suggestions if needed. So keeping your blood glucose under tight control is paramount. And over time, high blood glucose levels, or what we call hyperglycemia, can cause damage to almost every organ system of the body. You may have heard the term diabetes complications. So today, we are going to be discussing the complication that may affect your vision. And at this point, I would like to introduce Dr. Roy Cole. And also, thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. In starting, what I'd like to do before I talk specifically about diabetes is just do a quick review of some of the different vision changes that can take place in the eye with a lot of the different types of diseases that we're familiar with. I do have a few pictures here, but I'll describe them in case some of you are having trouble seeing them. We're starting with just a nice clear view of a subway entrance that's located right here near the Guild in New York City. And we can see that there's some stairs with a demarcation, a yellow demarcation showing a little lip, and there's a handrail in the middle. On the right, we see an example of just blurred vision. This is the kind of vision that we might see, for example, with some cataracts that cause everything to get blurred. The top left one is something I shouldn't have to talk a lot about to this group. That's basically central vision loss, as those of you with macular degeneration might be experiencing. It's possible for someone with diabetes to have this type of a loss. One of the changes that can take place that we'll be talking about is called edema of the macular, macular edema, that can cause central vision loss. So that's another change in the eye with disease. On the bottom left is a picture of a very reduced field of view where all we're seeing is one very small area. This could happen with things like glaucoma or retinitis pigmentosa. That's another eye change in the eye with disease. On the right-hand side, we see an example of the type of field loss that can occur when there's some type of involvement in the head, in the brain. Could be due to stroke or head trauma. And this is an example of a what we call a hemianopia or half field loss. Everything to the left is gone. Obviously, this could cause a problem when you're walking and not seeing people, for example, coming up the steps, or if you're walking in a crowd, bumping into people or open doors. On the top left is an example of severe glare. Any of you who've had a dilated eye exam and then walked out in the sun afterwards, as recently I had the opportunity to experience, knows what I'm talking about. A good analogy would be snow blindness. Everything just looks very white, and it actually can be very painful. This can happen in some eye conditions. On the upper right, we have a picture showing poor contrast. An example that I talk about with contrast is if you've ever driven in a car with a dirty windshield and everything looks washed out, if you're driving into the sun, that can also cause glare that we just were talking about. And these things can be due to, for example, cataracts or corneal changes, as well as retinal conditions. And, of course, as I've always said and as I've mentioned to Dan, just because you have the measles doesn't mean you can't get the mumps. So you can have combinations of these things, and the bottom picture actually would be a representation of an advanced diabetic who is having loss in the peripheral vision, some loss in the central, some blurred vision, hazy vision, sort of a little bit of everything. And, of course, an article just came out that talked about changes in the eye due to diabetes. And it basically went through every structure showing how diabetes can affect every part of the eye. So it is potentially a very debilitating condition, and that's why it's so important to do the things that Karen just talked about to keep it under control. I'd like to now discuss how does diabetes affect your vision. And one of the points that I want to make is that it is uncommon to have any symptoms, particularly very in the early stages of diabetic retinopathy. Usually the more severe vision loss will come later. I've spoken with Dan, who we know has had some experience with diabetes, and he has had really no vision changes at this point due to diabetes. But I have had some patients that have come to me because of vision changes, and I was actually the first person to pick up the fact that they did have diabetes. So some of the things that we've talked about can happen very early. And I know Dan was concerned about having everyone understand that if you have macular degeneration and you have a change in your vision, you don't want to necessarily just assume it's due to the macular degeneration, that there are other things that can cause changes in vision. So let's take a look at some of the things that can happen as diabetes advances. Well, first of all, I'm going to actually go to the second point, and that's blurred vision. The patient that came into me came in because all of a sudden he was nearsighted and could see very clear without his glasses, and his nearsightedness had actually disappeared. When I looked into his eye, I actually saw changes in the back of the eye that were reflective of diabetes and referred him to his physician. He got under care, and when I saw him next time, his vision was back to normal. So blurred vision or fluctuating vision can be a very early indicator of diabetes. And, of course, that's something that could be an early indicator of macular degeneration also. Seeing spots or dark strings floating in your vision, particularly suddenly, could be an indication, particularly if there's some bleeding in the eye. Dark or empty areas in your vision can be a symptom of diabetes. poor night vision, particularly in advanced patients because of some of the treatments, can be a problem. And if the macular area is involved, of course, it's possible to have impaired color vision, as I know a lot of you have been discussing on Dan's listserv. And just vision loss, severe vision loss, can be another problem that occurs as a result of diabetes. So let me talk a little bit about the different types of what we call diabetic retinopathy. Now, like I said, diabetes can affect a lot of parts of the eye, but the part that I'm going to be mainly concentrating on is the retina. And we refer to the impact of diabetes as diabetic retinopathy. For early diabetes, usually the type of retinopathy is called non-proliferative. This refers to non-proliferation of vascular growth in the retina. And we usually categorize it as mild, moderate, or severe, depending on what we see and where it is. Generally, what's happening in the early stages is the blood vessels are starting to weaken. We can actually see little microaneurysms, which are like little bulges in the blood vessels. And these can sometimes leak, and sometimes we'll actually see small hemorrhages in the retina. It's also possible for the retina to swell in different areas. If this happens in the center, we refer to that as macular edema. And I'll be talking about macular edema more, but that's something that can really happen at any stage of diabetes. Now, as the condition advances, we develop what's called advanced diabetic retinopathy. This is when blood vessels actually start growing in the retina, and this is referred to as proliferative diabetic retinopathy. So these abnormal vessels grow into the retina, and we can actually start to get bleeding. Some of the bleeding could actually go into the vitreous, which you recall is the gelatinous material that's inside the eye. And this can be very detrimental in terms of vision. We can also find scarring occurring, and we can get retinal detachments happening in advanced diabetes. And I have glaucoma down here because one of the other changes that can take place with diabetes is that the blood vessels that grow in the retina also grow in other parts of the eye. And they can grow in the iris, which is the colored part of the eye that you see when you look at the eye. And if they clog up what we call the angle, which is where the fluid drains out of the eye, this can cause pressure buildup in the eye, and that can lead to glaucoma. So glaucoma is another problem that can happen as a result of diabetes. In terms of testing for diabetic retinopathy, the main tests that are done are visual acuity, dilated exam, and tonometry. And I want to stress that it's important to have a dilated eye exam so that a good look can be taken of the fundus, that's the back of the eye, the retina, all the way out. And the other reason to dilate it is because you want the doctor to be able to get a binocular or stereoscopic view, because in order to see some of these edemas that are taking place, sometimes that's the best way to see it. So a dilated eye exam is very important. We'll be talking about when to get them a little bit later. Depending on what the doctor sees, sometimes they'll do a fluorescein angiogram, which is where they inject a dye into the eye to look for leakage. And again, that's something that's done with macular degeneration also at times. And also the OCT testing that you guys all talk about with macular degeneration is something that's also done to look for edema and swelling in the retina. So those are some tests that might be done depending on what stage you're at and what the doctor is seeing when he looks at the back of the eye. So what treatments are available? Well, first of all, let me say that the type of treatment is going to depend on what type of retinopathy. Do you have the non-proliferative or the proliferative? How severe is it? And if you've had any other treatments, how well did you do with them? In the case of the early diabetic or the non-proliferative, it's possible that you might not need treatments at all. Very often, the doctor is simply going to observe, because when we see these little hemorrhages, sometimes they just tend to go away. They reabsorb. But it's important to remember what we call the ABCs, and Karen talked about these. The A represents the A1C, which is the measurement of your blood sugar, and to have good blood sugar control is very important. The B represents blood pressure, and it's important to keep your blood pressure under control, and the C is the cholesterol, to keep your cholesterol under control. And these are all things that Karen discussed in terms of prevention and also in terms of treatment, and the same thing would apply to the eye, particularly in those who are in the early diabetic retinopathy stages. In terms of the advanced diabetic retinopathy, now there are some treatments that are actually surgical in nature. One is what's called scatter laser treatment, particularly when someone is having a lot of hemorrhages and leakages in the retina. And this is where they'll shoot a laser possibly 1,000 or a couple thousand times all around the periphery of the retina. It's called panretinal photocoagulation to try to stop the leakage of the fluid and to get it, the fluid to reabsorb. This is very destructive, as you know, and this can actually knock out a lot of the peripheral vision. And the philosophy is perhaps to sacrifice for the peripheral vision to save the central vision. But when we talked about having a really small field, it might not be from glaucoma. It could be due to this type of laser treatment. If there's a lot of bleeding into the vitreous, then sometimes a vitrectomy is necessary. That's where they actually remove the blood from the center of the eye. They remove the vitreous. This could be done for two reasons. Number one is when there's a lot of bleeding in the eye, it's impossible to look at the back of the eye or to use a laser to treat the back of the eye, so they have to clear out the obstruction. And the other thing, the blood in the retina can cause adherence. I'm sorry, the blood in the vitreous can cause adherence to the retina, and that can cause traction and result in a retinal detachment. They are looking at some medications now, and these are ones that I know you're all familiar with. These are the anti-VEGF medications, both the Macugen and the Avastin and the Lucentis, and they're looking at these in terms of some of the treatments for the advanced diabetic retinopathy. Now, for people who have macular edema, again, this can happen at any stage of diabetic retinopathy. In terms of the treatments, well, obviously the ideal treatment is primary prevention. But if that doesn't happen, there is a photocoagulation that's done for macular edema. It's called focal laser treatment. Basically, they go around the area to try to isolate the areas of leakage. A vitrectomy might be necessary if the photocoagulation doesn't work. And this is another area that they're using anti-VEGF therapy, Macugen, Lucentis, or Avastin. These are being investigated now. And they're also looking into corticosteroid therapy, both either injections or, in some case, they're starting to do a lot of research using the implants because it's better to avoid multiple injections if they can just put in an implant. One of the main points that I want to make is surgery, and these surgical procedures can slow or stop the progression, but it's really not a cure for the condition. So when should your eyes be checked? If you don't have diabetes, if you're diagnosed with type 1, a dilated eye exam, and again, I stress it, it must be a dilated eye exam, should occur within 5 years of diagnosis. And the reason we say within 5 years is because people with type 1 diabetes are generally diagnosed fairly early in the disease, and most of them have not had a chance to develop the diabetic retinopathy yet. So the emphasis on getting an immediate eye exam isn't quite as critical. However, for people who are diagnosed with type 2, as I mentioned earlier, it's possible to have this without any symptoms for a number of years. So we recommend almost an immediate dilated eye exam upon diagnosis of type 2. For people who are pregnant, if they already have diabetes, we generally recommend, obviously if this is a planned event, to have an eye exam before, but definitely during the first trimester of pregnancy, and then possibly again later, depending on what is seen at that first exam. And once the eyes are examined and once the diagnosis is made and the eyes are examined, then at least yearly after the initial eye exam, or depending on what's seen or if you're seeing any change in vision, you might need to have one earlier. A question sometimes comes up is, what happens if I don't have really any usable vision? Do I still need to have my eyes examined? And we do recommend it. The goal is we don't want people to develop any pain or discomfort. There are things that can happen in diabetes, even in a blind eye, that can cause pain or discomfort. So it is important to, again, periodically have an eye exam, even if there's very little vision. And this would be up to your eye care provider, and you can have a discussion with that individual. I just want to wrap up by talking about a couple of resources. I'm going to have Karen join me here in a second. One resource that's very good for information that we went to was the American Diabetes Association, and you can find that on the web. It's ada.org. And I'm going to turn this over to Karen to talk about the next one, which is the National Diabetes Information Clearinghouse.
Thank you, Dr. Cole. And I did want to say, if you visit this website, they have downloadable large print packets on many different areas of diabetes, such as food and diabetes, exercise and diabetes, complications and diabetes. So you may find this site useful. I believe also if you contact them, they could mail you anything in a booklet form.
Okay. In terms of the web, two sites that I found very useful are the mayoclinic.com, and when I went there, I just did a search for diabetic retinopathy and found a lot of the information that I use today. The National Eye Institute is also another very, very good reference if you look in the health information section. I just want to put a plug in for an organization that has a lot of very good information that many of you might not be familiar with, and that's the Medical Library Association. This is a group of librarians who are usually at university or type settings that have this organization. And if you go to their website, and it's mlanet.org, that's Medical Library Association Net, mlanet.org, there's a link for health consumers. And one of the interesting things they have there is what they call the top 10 most useful websites. These are websites that they recommend as being good, trustworthy sites that you can go to for good information. And so if you're looking for information, this is one place that you might want to go. And I just wanted to put a plug in for them. The librarian at the College of Optometry here in New York is part of this organization, has been very, very helpful. That's basically our presentation today. I want to thank Dan for giving us an opportunity to meet with you. And I think I'll turn it back over to see if we have any questions.
This is Dr. Huggett, Ed Huggett, and Dr. Cole and Ms. McCauley, thank you so much for the presentation. I really like a lot of what you said. Well, I liked everything that you said, but one thing that I thought was really particularly good was when you said that someone could have the mumps, but they could also have the measles, and that's so true. You know, that we see patients oftentimes when they have macular degeneration or glaucoma, and something else pops up and nobody's really looking for it. As we say in Florida, you can have a raccoon in the attic, but you can also have a gator in the basement. So that's very, very true. So the first question, I'm going to put it out to Dr. Cole and Ms. McCauley. Is lutein helpful? And by the way, they said thank you, great presentation. So tell us about lutein in regards to your perspective with the eyes and vision and diabetes.
Well, thank you for thanking us. In terms of lutein, I'm not going to say it's not helpful, but I will say that in all the reading that I've done, I haven't really seen it discussed in terms of diabetes. I think that some of the aspects of macular degeneration are a little bit different than diabetes, and that's why the lutein is probably helpful with the macular degeneration. But I don't see it having been talked about in terms of the diabetes.
A question I have, Dr. Cole and Ms. McCauley, do you have any thoughts or any information regarding the likelihood of developing macular degeneration if you have either type 1 or type 2 diabetes?
That's a good question, and I've been asking a lot of people that question, and there isn't any really good information that I've been able to find. Maybe when I'm done talking, you can give me your thoughts, Ed. There's definitely an association, but it's not necessarily cause and effect. You know, they say that you could argue that eating ice cream causes drowning because they both happen in the summer, but we know that it's not cause and effect. They just happen to happen at the same time. So they're associated in the sense that as we get older, we're more likely to have macular degeneration, we're more likely to have diabetes. And unfortunately, with the lifestyle of Americans, as our generation is getting older, we're probably going to see an increased incidence of the macular degeneration and diabetes. But I can't say that one causes the other. Also, if you look at the groups that are at higher risk, it's more probably a Caucasian group for macular degeneration, and it's a non-Caucasian group for diabetes. So there is separation there. But as we know, we've probably all spoken to or met with people who have macular degeneration, and some have diabetes, and so there's no question that they do occur together. I don't have any good statistics on that. Ed, maybe you do.
No, I sure don't, but I'll tell you, I'm gonna see what I can find out, and if I find out anything, and also yourself, if you find out anything, we'll go ahead and share that with the with Dan and with the groups and macular degeneration, the MDSupport.org. Well, thank you very much. I want to thank both Karen McCauley and Dr. Cole again. It was nice hearing your voice again, and hopefully we can meet up again sometime soon. Thank you so much for the outstanding and excellent presentation today and the information you brought to the table here. And I want to turn this back over to Dan Roberts. And Dan, if we could have you sign out. Also, if you wouldn't mind just putting a little plug in for the Ask the Doctor link on your website, that would be awesome.
All right. Yes, we have added to Dr. Ed's duties with MD Support. There is a link right on our homepage called Ask the Doctor, and that's going to be a direct link to Ed, where if you have any questions related to anything, he will do his best to either answer the question for you by email or find out what that answer is or send you the right direction. So be sure to go there first because Ed keeps his thumb on a lot of this information. And I also want to thank Karen and Roy for coming in today. Dr. Roy is one of my oldest friends, and he was very helpful to me getting started and in writing my book. And so we have a long history together, and I greatly appreciate his professionalism and his friendship. Next month, we are excited to have Tom Sullivan for a return visit. Some of you may remember Tom's visit with us a couple of years ago when he related some of his experiences as a blind athlete, musician, actor, and author. He's probably best remembered for his more than 50 appearances on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show and for his inspirational books on living with blindness. This time, Tom is going to give us a preview of his upcoming one-man Broadway show, and I know you won't want to miss that unique opportunity. So take care of yourselves and each other until then, and we'll see you again in November. Goodbye, everyone.